Tak dobrý večer, vážené dámy, vážení pánové. Dovolte mi, abych vás přivítal zde v aule Filozofické fakulty Univerzity Karlovy v Praze. Mé jméno je Tomáš Uher a budu vás provázet tuto přednáškou. Zároveň také vítám děkanku Filozofické fakulty, docentku Miriam Friedovou a samozřejmě našeho vzácného hosta, profesora matematiky a filozofie vědy na Oxfordské univerzitě, Johna Lennoxe. Tato přednáška byla iniciována univerzitním křesťanským hnutím a byla zaštítěna prorektorem, panem profesorem Janem Reutem a připravena ve spolupráci s Filozofickou fakultou. Téma přednášky Pohřbila věda Boha odráží kontrast mezi vědou a vírou. Na jednu stranu čerpáme z výsledků exaktních věd a sledujeme pokrok, a na druhé straně je tu inklinace k něčemu nebo k někomu, co nás přesahuje. Jde to skloubit? Neodporuje si to? Tak já bych poprosil paní děkanku o několik úvodních slov.
Dear colleagues, dear friends, I'm speechless. I don't think I've ever seen this hall this packed. So this is really wonderful and thank you all for coming. Needless to say, it is a great pleasure and privilege to welcome Professor Lennox at the Faculty of Arts and to thank him for finding the time to come to our university and give a lecture on a topic that has been gaining in prominence and has inspired sustained interest, not just among specialists and intellectuals, but even in the public sphere and among you all. And because it is a topic that is also practically by definition controversial, it is surrounded by all sorts of favorite interpretations, favorite misinterpretations, favorite misunderstandings, myths, and above all, heated passions that don't always allow for a calm, rational discussion. And yet, I feel that that's what we need the most, a level-headed and well-informed discussion about the relationship between science and faith, perhaps representing two sides of the complex nature of man as a being that has both a rational and a spiritual side. I personally truly welcome the chance in Professor Lennox's visit to hear a voice that will challenge us to ponder this complication and especially recently hotly debated question on both sides of the Atlantic. Professor Lennox comes to us from Oxford University, where he's a professor of mathematics and the philosophy of science, and tellingly, he also serves as an adjunct lecturer at the Oxford Center for Christian Apologetics. He is the author of innumerable publications on mathematics, philosophy of science, and religion, and has traveled around the world to give lectures and to engage in scholarly debates on the topics of his specializations. After all, I don't know if you all know it, but he's been even to Prague once before during the conference Darwin and Design, a Challenge for the 21st Century Science in the year 2005. Of his rich publication list, which I am not going to take the whole evening to recite, I would mention just some of his most recent books, such as Gunning for God and 7 Days That Divide the World, both published in the year 2011. Both of which present his arguments against some of the leading American atheists, such as Richard Dawkins and others, or the book God and Stephen Hawking, in which he replies to Hawking's book The Grand Design. And of course, God's Undertaker, Has Science Buried God?, which has been translated, by the way, into Hungarian, Italian, Swedish, and Brazilian Portuguese, at least. Unfortunately, not to Czech yet. It's waiting to happen. In sum, we are for a rich intellectual exercise, And so please welcome Professor Lennox.
Dobrý večer. Nemlevím česky. So I'll speak in English. Thank you very much, Madam Dean, for your welcome. It's an absolute thrill, first of all, to be in Prague, because one of my intellectual heroes was here. His name, Johannes Kepler. And Kepler plays a very important role in the debate that we'll be thinking about tonight. It was Kepler who said that the chief aim of all investigations of the external world is to use the language of mathematics to understand the rational order that God has imposed upon the world. And in that statement, he brings a number of ideas together: mathematics, language, the world, science. I'm in a philosophy faculty, and it is just, we have just heard from a professor of linguistics. I'm delighted at that, because at heart, I'm a linguist. I wanted to be, when I was young, a Latin specialist. And then I wanted to be an engineer. And then I was persuaded to do mathematics. But my language teacher at school made such a deep impression that I've carried the languages to this present day. And I'm glad I've done that. Because, of course, mathematics is at one end of the linguistic spectrum. It's the most compressed and accurate language we know. And so I feel I'm in between science and the arts. And that's why it is a particular honor, madam, to be in your faculty this evening. Thank you very much indeed. Now, our topic is controversial because all the big questions that we ask are controversial. What is ultimate reality? Is this universe all that exists? Those kind of questions, is there a God or is there no God? They are questions that are inevitably controversial. And in this room, we have many different world views. And we shall be talking about some of them in a moment. But let's think of the very widespread impression that science on the one hand and faith in God on the other hand contradict each other. That cannot be true. Last year, a very famous Scotsman, Peter Higgs, won the Nobel Prize for Physics. He's an atheist. A few years before that, Bill Phillips of the United States won the same prize. He's a Christian. Now, what can you deduce from that? Well, it's quite obvious that they are not divided by their physics. They've both won the Nobel Prize. They're both utterly brilliant. One, though, is an atheist, the other a Christian. So the difference between them is their worldview, not their science. And what I want to suggest to you tonight is a very simple proposition, is that there's no real conflict between science and belief in God. There is a conflict between worldviews, in this case, atheism and theism, Christian theism on the other side. So the real question that faces us is this: where does science point? Does it, like Richard Dawkins says, point to atheism? Or does it point to theism? Or does it point nowhere? Where does science point in our search for understanding what ultimate reality is? If you go back to the ancient Greeks, who were brilliant, of course, you have two schools of thought. You have people like Democritus and Leucippus, who were the founders of the atomic theory. They were geniuses. They had the idea of the atomos, something that could not be cut. And they were the forerunners, in many ways, of modern materialists, because the philosophy built on that was the universe consists of only two things, one, atoms, and two, empty space. And as the atoms fall through empty space, they cloud together to form galaxies and worlds and life and so on. There's nothing else. Of course, in the ancient world, there was Socrates, one of my heroes, because he learned to ask questions. Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, who said, okay, there is the universe, but there's more. There is transcendence. There are the gods, or there is God. And coming up through the centuries to the 21st century in Prague, we find those two worldviews in the academy. Now, there are other worldviews, but for the purpose of this discussion tonight, the major players are materialism stroke naturalism, which is atheism, and on the other hand, theism, in my case, Christian theism. And what I'm suggesting to you is this. I'm suggesting that science and God mix perfectly well. And I'm going to be very provocative towards the end and suggest that atheism and science do not mix well. So let me say that again, just in case you did not hear me. I'm going to suggest to you that science and God mix as Kepler believed, but that atheism and science are in real trouble. So let me approach this, and we're going to give you opportunity to ask questions. Now, of course, I'm a pure mathematician, so in my discipline, we have a thing called proof. You probably understand that. But the nature of that is not the same as proof in any other discipline. Because it starts with axioms, proceeds on accepted logic, and comes to conclusions. That's simplistic. I know there are all kinds of problems with that. But in all other disciplines of natural science, physics, chemistry, we cannot speak of rigorous proof. We can only speak of evidence, of pointers, of indicators, and so on. Now, of course, that doesn't mean we cannot be certain of them. I've been married for 46 years. I cannot prove to you mathematically that my wife loves me. But I'd stake my life on it. I came to Prague yesterday on a jet. I couldn't prove to you mathematically it would get me here. But I risked my life on it for you lot. So, we do have sufficient evidence. So, what I'm going to be talking about is the evidence. Why would I, as a mathematician at Oxford, believe in God and not be an atheist? That's what I'm going to explain to you. Firstly, we start in Prague with Kepler. But there were other people in Prague, weren't there? There was Galileo as well. And Tycho Brahe, and a number of the most famous scientists in history. They believed in God, as did Isaac Newton. We had at least one in England, you see. We have to compete with the Czech on that score. Now, here's the interesting thing. The pioneers of modern science all believed in God. They didn't see a difficulty in believing in God, far less than that. It was their faith in God that was the motor that drove their science. C.S. Lewis put it this way, and I used to listen to him. I'm very old, ladies and gentlemen. You must realize that. I remember C.S. Lewis in Cambridge, and he wrote, "Men became scientific." Why? Because they expected law in nature. And they expected law in nature because they believed in a lawgiver. That's what Kepler said was the purpose of science, using mathematics to discover the rational order that God had imposed on the universe. Now, this is vastly important because I need to emphasize this. They saw no conflict, but it wasn't that at all. It was they were doing their science because of their commitment to the existence of God. Now, of course, that poses a very interesting situation, because Newton's chair, let me just stick with Newton. Newton's chair at Oxford until recently was occupied by Stephen Hawking. You've all heard of Stephen Hawking, haven't you? He's the most famous living scientist, and he has battled against motor neurone disease and so on for many years, and will win the Nobel Prize if Hawking radiation actually is shown to be true. He holds Newton's chair. He believes that there is no God. Now, here's the interesting thing. When Newton discovered his law of gravity, it was an impulse for him to write the most brilliant book in the history of science, the Principia Mathematica. And he said in it, "I hope that this book persuades thinking people to believe in a deity, in God." So his discoveries about the universe were put into a book, and he hoped that would help people to believe in God. Stephen Hawking says, because there is a law of gravity, there is no need to believe in God. Now that's very interesting to me. What has happened between Newton and Hawking? And I believe what has happened between Newton and Hawking can help us understand the heart of what this debate is all about. Why is it Newton says the law of gravity, God? Hawking says the law of gravity, no God. That encapsulates the argument pretty sharply. So what we've got now in many academic situations in the West is, as Hawking puts it, you must choose between God and science. If you want to be thought of as an intelligent person in the 21st century, you must forget God. And there's enormous pressure. Hawking and Dawkins both believe that God is a delusion, like Santa Claus. Now, I think we got Santa Claus from the Czech Republic, didn't we? No? Where did we get it from? From Finland. Now, you see, it's good to have a professor of linguistics here. I've learned something tonight. So, you all know who Santa Claus is, yes? Father Christmas. What do you call him in Czech? Oh, I see. Oh, goodness me. That complicates it a great deal for me. That sounds much more realistic than our idea of Santa Claus, who is our parents dressed up to give presents. You know that idea. So, Santa Claus belongs with fairy stories. And Stephen Hawking was asked what he thought about religion. And he said, religion is a fairy story for people afraid of the dark. And I was asked by one of the British newspapers what I would say to that. And I said, do you want a long quote or a short one? Oh, a short one, please. So I said, atheism is a fairy story for people afraid of the light. Well, don't clap, because neither of those statements proves anything. They're simply statements of belief. And it's interesting that this argument is often the argument that stops the conversation even beginning. The argument from Sigmund Freud, that belief in God is an illusion or a delusion. We want a father figure in the sky, and so we invent our gods. One of Germany's leading psychiatrists is Manfred Lütz, and he's written a very interesting book called Eine kleine Geschichte des Größten. I expect you all to understand that. A brief history of the great one, that is of God. And Lutz says this. He says, of course, if there is no God, Freud's argument that religion is a wish fulfillment is brilliant. It works if there is no God. Of course, he said, if there is a God, the very same argument shows that atheism is a delusion for exactly the same reasons. As Czesław Miłosz put it in his, he won the Nobel Prize for Literature, and he said, atheism is the great opium of the people, the desire not to ever have to give account to God for the things that we've done wrong. So you see, the argument works both ways. If there's no God, Freud, religion is a fairy story. If there is a God, atheism is a fairy story for the same reason. And then he says, the bottom line is, on the substantive question, whether there is a God or not, neither Freud, Jung, Frankl, or anybody else can help you. You have to look elsewhere for the evidence. I want now to analyze very briefly where I think the problems lie. And the first problem is confusion about the nature of God. Now let me try to explain that. When I was much younger and I would give a lecture and mention the word God, people would understand that I meant the infinite, eternal, triune God of the Bible who created and sustains the universe. But of course, all that has changed. And what I've discovered now is that when I use the word God, many people think that I'm referring to a kind of Greek god, say the god of lightning. Now, of course, you know that if you go to the first lecture in atmospheric physics in Charles University, at the end of that lecture, you will not need or believe in the god of lightning. You'll understand how lightning works. Because gods like that are what we call gods of the gaps. I can't explain it, therefore God did it. And you know, that danger exists today. People look at things like they can't explain them and they say, therefore God did them. The difficulty with that is obvious. That as science advances, the space for God gets smaller and smaller until he disappears. Now, what I want to say is this. If you believe in a God like that, you have to choose between God and science, because that's the way you've defined God. And what I discover today is that many of my scientific colleagues at Oxford and elsewhere, they think of God exactly as that, the unknown X that some people use to fill the gap that science will one day fill. And so, of course, by definition, elementary logic shows you, you have to choose between God and science if that's your idea of God. But that's not the idea that most of us who believe in God believe in anyway. The God Newton believed in and Kepler believed in and Galileo believed in was not a God of the gaps, he was the God of the whole show. The bits we do understand and the bits we don't understand. So, when Newton discovers his law of gravity, he doesn't say, I've got a law of gravity, I don't need God. No. He writes the Principia and says, what a genius God is to do it that way. In other words, the more he understood about the universe, the more he believed in the God that did it that way. And that's true. The more you understand of engineering, the more you can admire the genius of a Rolls Royce. The more you understand painting, the more you can admire the genius of a Rembrandt. Not the less. That's the way it works. And so the more I study of the universe, the more I admire the genius of the God that did it that way. Not the less. Why? Because I do not believe in a God of the gaps. Now that's point number one. The next point is related to it. What we're talking about is the nature of explanation. What do we actually mean when we use the word explain? Science explains. But what do you mean by that? See, when I was at school, which was centuries ago, when I was at school, I learned the law of gravity. Well, there we are. But you know what I thought? I thought I then knew what gravity was. When I discovered that no one, not even today, knows what gravity is, I was staggered. The law of gravity is brilliant. It enables you to land a person on the moon without even Einstein's corrections. But it does not tell you what gravity is. And Newton had the intelligence to see that. Wittgenstein put it brilliantly, didn't he? Wittgenstein said, the greatest deception of modernism is that the laws of nature are explanations of the phenomena of nature. They are not. They are descriptions with predictive power, but they are not explanations. Now, here's the irony of the situation. We constantly hear, science explains, I don't need God. When science explains is only a partial statement of explanation. Now, it's very important we realize that. Having a law is only one thing. That doesn't tell you what the thing is. We don't know what energy is. We don't know what gravity is yet. So that's point number one. Point number two is still about the nature of explanation. I think a lot of the problem of conflict, imagined conflict between science and God, is that God is not the same kind of explanation as science. Let me explain that. Why is the kettle boiling? Well, because heat energy from a Bunsen flame is being conducted through the copper base of the kettle. And that heat is being transferred into the water molecules that are getting very uneasy and agitated and starting to move very fast. That's why the kettle's boiling. No, it isn't. It's boiling because I want a cup of tea. Now, why do you laugh? Because you can immediately see that that's an absurd statement. No, it's not. Yes, it is. Because what I've given to you are two kinds of explanation of a phenomenon. I've given you a scientific explanation in terms of the water molecules movement, and I've given you an agent explanation or a teleological explanation or a purposeful explanation or an intentional explanation. I desire a cup of tea. Now, would you ever imagine thinking those two explanations conflict with each other? That's absurd. But that's what I meet all the time. That people think that if we got a scientific explanation, then the God explanation contradicts it. That's nonsense. They're not even in the same philosophical category. Let me give you an even simpler example. God no more competes with science as an explanation than Henry Ford competes with the law of internal combustion as an explanation for the motor car. Who would ever think of saying, do you know, I've been studying Ford motor cars, and I can tell you that their motor is a result of engineering and the law of internal combustion, so I don't need Henry Ford. That would be sheer foolishness. And yet I hear it from some of those brilliant minds in the world. It's confusion of levels of explanation. The God explanation is not the same as a scientific explanation, just as the Henry Ford explanation is not the same as a scientific explanation. Now, of course, at this point, often an objection comes, particularly from Richard Dawkins, but since his book is very popular, I find it from almost everybody. And they say, just stop. and think. If you claim that God created this universe, then logically, you will have to ask who created God. Have you heard that before? And then you'll have to ask who created the God that created the God that created the God that created the God that created the God. And it goes on forever. So it's nonsense. So let's forget about God and do something serious like playing football. I was amazed when I found that statement at the heart of the God delusion. I was staggered. I used to get it in the Russian Academy of Sciences, but that's a different story. From professors who had real difficulty with eternal concepts. But from Dawkins, that was very interesting. I mean, let's do a bit of logic. I know it's late at night, but it's not too late for logic. No, it's not. I've been given authority to do some logic. So, who created God? Well, let's make it simpler. Who or what created X? Now, that question has got an assumption in it. It assumes that X was created. If you ask who or what created X, you're assuming X was created, aren't you? But what if X was not created? The question doesn't even apply. So this question that's supposed to dismiss faith in God completely doesn't even apply to the God of the Bible anyway. It does apply to created gods, of course, that's quite correct. But it doesn't apply to the God of the Bible because the central claim is that God is eternal. He wasn't created. So to ask who or what created something not created is just meaningless. But there's more to it than that. Because when Dawkins and I had our little public discussion about the matter, which you can see on my website, I'll forget to mention it later, johnlennox.org, I said to him, I said, Richard, let me ask you your question. You believe the universe created you. Okay, I said, you think your question's valid. Who created your creator? I'm still waiting for the answer, and it's now 8 years ago. You see, really what we're talking about here is ultimate reality. The questions don't go back forever, in my experience, on either side. Many of my atheist friends, and I have many, they think that the questions stop with the universe, the multiverse, mass energy, and the latest candidate is nothing. You get the universe from nothing. And if you want me to talk about that, I will, but not now, in the questions. Others, like myself, think the questions stop with God. He's the ultimate reality. So, each side has an ultimate reality, so the real question is, not is there an ultimate reality, but which reality is ultimate? So that's a little approach to some of those things. Now, the next confusion, if I might put it that way, is confusion about the nature of faith. This is one of the most difficult, I find, because people meet me and they say, I believe in God, I have faith in God, I trust in God. All those words in their original cognates in Greek and Latin have the same meaning. But now the definition has been subtly changed. Language changes. And you see now, and it's got into Webster's dictionary, here's the new entry, faith, noun, believing where there is no evidence. That's in the dictionary now. If you look at the Oxford English Dictionary, which has not yet been contaminated, but no doubt will be, faith, Latin, fides, trust, loyalty, and it raises all those questions. When I say I believe in X, or I trust X, or I have confidence in X, your next question is, on what basis? What's your evidence for your trust? But now, you see, the subtle redefinition is that faith is a religious word alone, and it means believing where there's no evidence. So I'm in the difficult position of being called a man of faith, which is an insult, Because it means I believe, for there's no evidence, and so there's no point in talking to me. Well, that's a very cheap cop-out in the world in which I live. Believing where there's no evidence is blind faith. And that can, of course, be very dangerous. Now, I can't speak for other religious traditions. They have every right to speak for themselves and should do so. But the Christian faith is not blind faith. And that ought to be obvious, because it's geared into history. And one of the central statements made in the New Testament when explaining this is there's a whole book of evidence called the Gospel of John. And at the end of it, the early apostle writes this. He said, Jesus did many other signs, semion, from which you get semiotics, indicators of the reality of who he was. He did many other signs that are not written in this book. But these are written in order that you might believe, have faith, trust that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life in his name. In other words, John's saying, here's the evidence. I've searched it out. So to say that Christianity is blind faith is to ignore its central doctrine. And I wouldn't stand here for a moment if I didn't consider my faith to be evidence-based. That's a good term from contemporary medicine these days. Everything's got to be evidence-based. And not only in medicine, but everywhere else. So that's the one side. The other side is equally dangerous. If you think that all faith is blind faith, it will blind you to the fact that faith is central to science. Galileo, Kepler, Newton, all of them believed that science could be done. Now, they believed science could be done because they believed in a rational creator. But just stop at the first level. You see, all of my scientific colleagues and I share the same faith, not in God, but in the fact that science can be done. But do you see what that means? It means that we believe that the universe is, at least in part, accessible to the human mind. That's what every academic discipline. Now, you have to believe that before you start. I was taught physics many years ago, quantum physics, by John Polkinghorne. And he constantly says in his books this, physics is powerless to explain its faith in the mathematical intelligibility of the universe. Why? Because you have to believe that before you do any physics at all. So here's a very interesting situation. I now want to ask, what is the rational justification for my belief that science can be done? Now we're moving, as you'll see in a moment, right into the mainstream of the debate. And we start, interestingly enough, and it might surprise you, with Charles Darwin. And he made this statement. With me, the horrid doubt always arises, whether the convictions of man's mind, which has been developed from the mind of the lower animals, are of any value or at all trustworthy. Would anyone, he wrote, trust in the convictions of a monkey's mind, if there are any convictions in such a mind? Now, follow the logic of this. What Darwin is saying, that he's doubting the validity of reason. C.S. Lewis got onto this in the 1940s, but nobody really pursued it as they should have done. C.S. Lewis said this, science has been very effective because we've been using human reason to penetrate the natural world, as Kepler advised. But he said what we have failed to do is to think about thinking. We've thought about the natural world, but we haven't thought about thinking. And once you begin to think about thinking and ask what is the status and validity of the human rational faculty, you come to some very, very interesting questions indeed. John Gray is a professor emeritus of the history of European thought in London. He's an atheist. He writes very interesting stuff, including this. Modern humanism is the faith, notice the word, that through science humankind can know the truth and so be free. Now, this is an atheist writing. It's not me writing. Listen to this. But if Darwin's theory of natural selection is true, this is impossible. The human mind serves evolutionary success, not truth. That's exactly picking up Darwin's own problem. Now, let me come to two contemporary philosophers, both world famous, one a Christian, one an atheist. The first is Alvin Plantinga of the University of Notre Dame in America. If Dawkins is right, that we are the product of mindless, unguided natural processes, then he has given us strong reason to doubt the reliability of human cognitive faculties, and therefore inevitably to doubt the validity of any belief that they produce, including Dawkins' own science and his atheism. His biology and his belief in naturalism would therefore appear to be at war with each other in a conflict that has nothing whatever to do with God. In other words, Plantinga is saying that its atheism now is clashing with science. But when Thomas Nagel wrote his book a couple of years ago, it set cyberspace alight. It's worth Googling it. Thomas Nagel's book has a very, very simple title. It's called Mind and Cosmos. It was the subtitle that caused the trouble. Now, Thomas Nagel is one of the world's leading philosophers in New York. He's an atheist. He's a very strong atheist. He said, I do not want there to be a God. And here's what he writes. He said, the subtitle of his book is this: Why the Neo-Darwinian view of the world is almost certainly false. What? That's staggering, and you can see the reactions in cyberspace. But here is part of his reason. And it's Lewis's reason and it's Plantinga's reason. He says, if the mental is not itself merely physical, it cannot be fully explained by physical science. Evolutionary naturalism implies that we should not take any of our convictions seriously, including the scientific world picture on which evolutionary naturalism itself depends. Now, that's where the heart of the debate is today, I believe. It's raising the question. Here's Richard Dawkins. He trusts in doing science. Let me record a little conversation I had, not with him, but with several others. I sometimes ask scientists what they do science with. They say, I've been given $1 billion and I've got the greatest machine in the world for studying X-rays at the back of Venus. I say, I don't mean that. I mean this. You mean my, and they almost say mind, but then they say brain, because they don't think there is a mind separate from the brain. Well, let's leave that. So I said, tell me about this brain with which you do science. Well, they said, do you want the long story? No, I say, I want the short story. Well, the short story is, the brain is the end product of a mindless process that didn't foresee it. So I listen to that and I say, and you trust it? And you trust it. If you knew that your iPod or iPad or iMac or PC was the end product of a mindless, unguided process, you wouldn't even use it, would you? So why do you trust the end product of a mindless, unguided process? I don't get many convincing answers to that. Because this is what Nagel is saying. Now, this, I'm coming to my last point now. This is another aspect of explanation. You see, in the natural sciences mainly, we are taught that a good explanation comes from the simple to the complex. Yes? And you explain complex things in terms of simple things. In other words, you reduce the complex to the simple. That's what we call reductionism. And it works, of course. In everyday life, we use what's called methodological reductionism. And you students will do this all the time. You get a big problem. Your professor says, solve this big problem. Yes. Yes, sir. Or yes, ma'am. And what you do is try and split it into smaller problems. Solve the small problems and get insight on the big problems. That's what we call methodological reductionism. But there's another kind. Well, there's several other kinds. But there's another kind called ontological reductionism. From the Greek word ontos, meaning being. For example, one might say that this notice is nothing but molecules of canvas and paint. The nothing but word is the characteristic of ontological reductionism. And this idea that you can always go from the simple to the complex works marvelously in many areas. There's one area it doesn't work, and that's where language is involved. Let me tell you a little story. It is story time because I'm nearly finished. May I tell you a story about my college? Well, we have these nice dinners on Thursday night, and they're great, but you can't always choose who sits beside you. So I found myself sitting beside a very eminent biochemist, and he made the mistake of asking me, what do you do? And I said, I'm a pure mathematician. Oh, he said, how dreadfully boring. Unfortunately, he meant it. And he said, what kind of a mathematician? Algebra, I said. Oh, he said, even worse, that's terrible. So I was a little embarrassed. So I said, you know, I tried to make up for the unsociable nature of my academic field by being interested in bigger things and bigger questions. He said, what bigger questions? Well, I said, you know, the universe out there, what is its status? Is it created or not? Human life, what is its status? Is it made in the image of God, or is it just the result of random unguided processes? Oh dear, he said, it's far worse than I thought. He said, listen, I'm a reductionist, I'm a materialist, I'm an atheist. We have nothing to talk about. We're going to have a miserable evening. So that was a big challenge. So I said, no, we're going to have a wonderful evening. He said, why? Well, I said, reductionism is fascinating. I know at least three kinds. What kind are you? I said, I suspect you're a methodological reductionist. And I explained what I've just explained to you. And he said, yes. Well, I said, we can at least talk about that. Because I do that too. He said, that's not what I mean. I said, I know it's not what you mean. You're an ontological reductionist. And he said, that's exactly right. I believe everything can be reduced to physics and chemistry. Oh, I said, that's very interesting. Really? Yes, he said, I do. Well, I said, why don't we do an experiment? He said, this is the dinner table. I said, yes, but it's Oxford. So he said, what's the experiment? So I picked up the menu, and on the menu, I don't know that I can write on this, can I? Probably not. No, never mind. You can imagine it. On the menu, it said roast chicken. Not even in French. It wasn't even very imaginative. So he said, what's the problem? Well, I said, look at this. R-O-A-S-T. Yes, he said, I can see that's roast. I said, how could you see that? I said, it appears to have some meaning for you. Yes, he said, of course, it's roast. What's the problem? Well, I said, you told me you're a reductionist. He said, that's right. I said, will you please explain to me the semiotics of those symbols and the way they carry the meaning roast in terms of the physics and chemistry of the paper and ink? So there was a silence, and his wife was there. And she said, get out of that if you can. I never forget it. But, you know, what happened next was stunning. He didn't try. And he said, John, he was getting friendly now. He said, for 40 years I've gone into my lab in Oxford thinking that could be done. I was staggered at the honesty of it. I said, come on. I said, physics and chemistry have only been operating for about 500 years. He said, it doesn't matter. I said, why doesn't it matter? Because he said, it's not within the explanatory power of physics and chemistry to cope with meaning and writing and semiotics. And he looked at me for a long time, and I could see what he was thinking. You're not bright enough to have thought of that argument. And he more or less said it. I said, I confess it. I got it from a Nobel Prize winner. Oh, he said, that's all right. Roger Sperry, who told the medical world that they've got to take consciousness seriously. It's very interesting, isn't it? The moment you see text, you infer upwards to a mind behind that text. Now, in producing this poster, there may have been many automatic processes, many blind processes, many not so blind steered by computers. But the moment you see this, and you only have to see those three letters, that's all. And you know there's a mind behind it. So I pushed my biochemical friend. And I said, R-O-A-S-T has five letters. And I said, in your lab, what do you work with? He said, DNA. Oh, I said, DNA. And what do you think about DNA? Because I said, your colleagues tell me that there's a chain of codons. That means they carry meaning, doesn't it? Yes, he said, it does. They code for the proteins. I said, just remind me how long the DNA word is. He said, 3.5 times 10 to the 9. 3.5 billion letters. I said, what about that then? Treat it as a black box. And you come across a black box with the longest word we've ever discovered in any language. Oh, well, he said, chance and the laws of nature. I said, half a minute, you looked at R-O-A-S-T. I said, what's the difference? He didn't know. And I found many people don't know. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to close with this. I am fascinated as a scientist living in the information age. Living to see that not only is Nagel right, but there's much more to this. Theoretical computer science tells us, doesn't it, that natural processes are good at transmitting information. They cannot create it. And I think in the days to come, people are going to have to take much more seriously this irony of 21st century physics, and it's this. Materialism is very deeply embedded, or naturalism, which is slightly different, embedded in the culture. But they fail to deal with language. They fail to deal with anything semiotic, because the moment you see language, it implies mind. Now, here's the interesting thing. Information of the type that's on this is not material. Its carrier is material, but the information is not material. And here's the irony of 21st century science. We've come to see that one of the most important fundamental entities is information which is not material. That creates difficulty with materialism. I started by talking about worldviews. I'll finish by talking about worldviews. The dominant worldview in the Western Academy is materialism stroke naturalism. There is no God, there's no transcendence, so everything arises bottom up by chance of the laws of nature, wherever they came from, including mind and language. There is another view. It starts like this. In the beginning was the word, logos. The same, the word was God, the word was with God, the same was in the beginning with God. All things came to exist through him, and without him nothing came to exist that came to exist. This is a fascinating statement from the ancient world. It's the first statement in John's gospel. In the beginning, the word already was. That's a statement of existence. It's saying the word was eternal. And the Greeks at the time and before it were very interested in, are there eternal things or did everything come to exist? And what John says into that world is God never came to exist. The word already was. The universe came to exist. And it came to exist through the word. That's the exact opposite of materialism. Do you see the difference in the worldviews? One starts with mass energy and ends up with mind and the idea of God, because there isn't a God. The other starts with God, with mind, and everything else is derivative. And you see, it's not only as a Christian, but as a scientist that I think the second explanation is infinitely better than the first. In my world, I prefer an explanation that makes sense to one that doesn't make sense. And when my colleagues tell me they're trusting something that they believe is the end product of a mindless, unguided process, I suggest to them this. I say, you know, you're not only shooting yourself in the foot. That's quite painful if you've ever tried it. You're shooting yourself in the brain, and that's fatal. Which makes more sense? And it's the God explanation makes infinitely more sense to me than the idea that everything has been self-generated, not only from mass energy, but actually from nothing. That doesn't make sense at all. So, ladies and gentlemen, I'm just so glad I believe the same thing as Johannes Kepler. Thank you very much. Right, now it's your turn. What we're going to do is what I always do. In a crowd like this, everybody is interested in the other person's questions. You've probably noticed that. So what we're going to do is, I know you want to find out, and I want to find out the spectrum of questions that's going on in your mind. So I'm going to collect 4 or 5 questions before I answer any of them. So what I'm going to ask you to do, there are roving microphones, is to stand up, ask your question, remembering that the time you take for your question is time taken away from the next person. So it's a question time, not a statement time, a question time that I've been asked to do. And I will write them down, and when I've got enough, which will be in about the first 30 seconds, I think, I will attempt to answer them. So off we go. Put up your hand. And somebody at the front will see you and get a mic to you. Okay.
Thank you very much. I don't know. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much for coming here, and I think it was a great pleasure having you here in this infidel country.
Well, thank you.
I hope the question won't be that long, but actually,
well, so do I, and so do they.
So. Okay, you used on several occasions. You used the heroes of science, saying those were good Christians too, and then you of course used people who were good atheists or still are good atheists too. But as to, you know, the great hero of science, Isaac Newton, I think I've read somewhere that he was very fond of astrology as well. Mm-hmm. So does it by the same token mean that his point about God is as valid as his point about astrology?
Okay, thank you. Number two.
Tak jestli můžeme tady dopředu ve třetí řadě.
Well, first of all, thank you for your enlightening lecture. My question actually regards something you touched on only briefly, and that is where you make the jump from deism to theism.
Okay. Where did I make the jump from deism to theism? Okay.
Vlevo, někde uprostřed pod oknem, vlevo.
Hello. You made a very interesting point about theoretical computer science talking about transforming information.
Yes.
Most of theoretical computer science is based on the idea of Turing machines.
Correct.
Which do not assume any randomness. And many scientists are talking about a random process. So whether you could elaborate on that, maybe.
Okay.
První třetině ze zhora, uprostřed.
Number four, please.
When you speak of the idea of a certain perfect universe, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but...
Well, don't.
Yeah. But that's the way it kind of sounds to me, that, you know...
go and ask your question. Didn't use the word perfect, but you did. But you ask your question.
The idea is that our universe needs to be perfect, because if it weren't,
hear what you're saying.
That our universe needs to be perfect, because if it weren't, we wouldn't be here to perceive it. So if there is an imperfect universe, there wouldn't be us, and there wouldn't be anyone to perceive it. So how can there even be an imperfect universe, a universe where the laws of gravity don't apply?
Okay, where... I've got the question. Thank you. Next.
Tady ve čtvrté řadě, pan v modrém světru.
Brief question. Do you agree with the statement that Jesus was not only son of man, but also God?
It's a brief question, yes.
A za ním pan v bledém modrém světru?
Okay, one more perhaps, or two. I'll get to seven and then we'll quit. Yes.
Is the law of gravity less fascinating to you without a God to have created it? And if so, why?
That's an interesting one. Is the law of gravity less fascinating if there were no God?
A ve třetí řadě ze spoda vlevo?
Yeah. Okay, I've got it. Seven, last one.
I want to ask only one question. You have mentioned energy. And I want to ask if there is something between God and energy.
Something between God and energy?
Yeah, something like cooperating. They are cooperating together.
Okay, let's have a go at these. Now, this is a Q&A. Do you know what that means? It means it's inadequate. Why? Because most of these questions need a lecture. So you got a choice. Do you want a lecture in each question, or do you want one or two suggestions? I'm only going to give my initial reaction to these, and that's okay, because most of you are students, and if you have questions, the best work is the work you do in investigating them. So it's going to be inadequate by definition. Okay, well, let's have a go. Not necessarily in the order in which we got the question. But I will start with Newton and so on. And he did indeed have some very funny views about astrology. What I notice is that most scientists don't believe his views of astrology, but his law of gravitation, his optics, and all the rest of it have pushed themselves through. That's point number one. Of course, the second point to make is this, that at least we must listen to Newton and Kepler, that their motivation and their conviction in doing this stuff was their belief in God. Now, they did have some wacky ideas about God. But of course, the wacky ideas get tuned out a bit as we look at other people. That's point number two. Point number three is this. When I mentioned this to Richard Dawkins, he said, but look, he said, everybody believed in God in Europe in those days, or in the world, he said, everybody believed in God. And I said, your world's too small. The Chinese didn't. And here's a very interesting phenomenon, because the question, why did modern science not develop in China? Explosives, brilliant technology, printing, all that kind of stuff, but no abstract science. And the man that did the most work on it in Cambridge was Joseph Needham, who was firstly a brilliant chemist and secondly one of the world's top sinologists, experts in Chinese, who wrote the definitive dictionary and encyclopedia to Chinese technology. He was a neo-Marxist. And for years, he tried to explain why the Chinese did not develop modern science. He tried to base his thinking on neo-Marxism, but he failed. And at the end, he wrote some very interesting stuff, and it was this. He said, I have come to the conclusion that the major difference between the East and the West was that the East did not have the unifying concept of a single creator who created a universe according to certain laws. Now, I think that transcends the objection, although I understand it perfectly well. So that's all I have to say on that. So let's move on. Computing, Turing machines, and so on. My understanding of this, which may well be limited, but the people that work on this, like Bernd Olaf Kuppers and so on, I think the point they're making is that any computer, past, present, or future, can be simulated by a Turing machine on the basis of the Church-Turing thesis. Okay. Now, I'm going on this in a very basic level, that a cell is, at the very least, an information processor. It's a lot more than that. So, therefore, you would expect the kind of things that Gregory Chaitin at the Bell Labs has discovered to apply to it. And that's all I was stating there, that a Turing machine cannot create any information that's not either A, in its informational structure, or in its input. And if that is the case, it seems to me that biologists are going to have a vast difficulty in thinking that an information processor is producible by unguided naturalistic forces. That's all I'm saying. The next level, of course, is that we are not only based on a text in part in our DNA code, we are text producers. We can speak. We can produce language. But that's to take it a lot further than I could possibly do tonight. So let's go on to the universe needs to be perfect, otherwise we wouldn't be here. Now, the word perfect is not a word I use much, because I always ask, what do you mean by it? But in the context of the question, I think you're referring to the usual fine-tuning argument. This world is very special, otherwise we wouldn't have been here. Whether it needs to be perfect, whatever that means, because if you're engineering something, perfection is actually never achievable. You have to have a compromise, because you'll probably discover as you get older that as age goes up, weight goes up. And that creates certain problems for physical movement and so on. So you cannot scale a fly up to the size of an elephant. So perfection, I don't think, is the word to use, but your question is a very valid one. And the argument often is, look, here we are. We wouldn't be here if the universe hadn't been productive of creatures like us. And of course, that's true. But what does that prove? That simply gives a surprise effect. It doesn't solve anything, because what it doesn't do is answer the question, why is the universe like it is? And it's very interesting you raise this, because this specialness of the universe is something my atheist friends always like me to talk about. For this reason, it's very generous of them. They say to me, you know, we hope you're going to use your best argument against atheism. So when somebody offers me that chance, I of course ask them, what is my best argument against atheism? And they say the best argument against atheism is fine-tuning. If I were ever to become a believer in God, it would be because of fine-tuning. Now, what our friend is referring to is the amazing thing that science has discovered in the last 50, 60 years. The fine-tuning of the universe is staggering, ladies and gentlemen. One of my colleagues is Sir Roger Penrose, just as bright as Hawking, maybe even brighter. And Roger Penrose says, and he's not a theist, he says, to get a universe like this, where there's a second law of thermodynamics, the creator's aim has got to be accurate to one part in 10 to the power 10 to the power 123. Which, if you write a 1 here and a 0 on every elementary particle in the universe, you can't write it out to the base 10. And I'm interested in what people like Roger Davis say about it. He's not a theist either, but he says the impression of design is overwhelming. I think that surprise factor raises the question. It's not an answer. Richard Dawkins got it completely confused in his book when he thought it was an answer, and he pitched the so-called anthropic principle against God. But that's another confusion that I won't go into. Next question is the law of gravity less fascinating if there were no God? Yes and no. Because, you see, when I'm teaching the law of gravity or Kepler's laws in the university, I don't even mention God. I'm teaching mathematics. And in itself, it's fascinating. But you see, what we're talking about is the higher level. That question is very interesting to me, because aren't you curious? I mean, most people I meet in universities are really curious, and if they see the fact that you can describe in 8 symbols one of the most powerful discoveries in science, not to ask the question, how is that possible? Einstein did ask the question, and he said, the only incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it's comprehensible. Why is it comprehensible? Now, if you decide not to ask the question, that's fine. But I'm surprised at you if you don't. So I want to say, of course I find gravity with God more fascinating, but it's not gravity with God, it's that gravity points to God. It's much more than that. The law of gravity formulated in language, if there were no God, we wouldn't begin to understand it, because as I've just been arguing to you, don't have any rationality unless it's backed up by a rational mind. It goes much deeper than just saying, do you like gravity with or without God? It's not like, do you like your apple pie with or without ice cream? It's a much deeper philosophical question than that. And the whole thing belongs together. I'm curious, you see. That's why I do what I do. I'm interested in questions. And I recall Paul Davis saying, you know, it strikes me as a physicist as very curious when people study the laws of nature, they study the universe, they study the stars, and then they say, well, what about the universe? Well, it just is. It just is, as Bertrand Russell said. He said, I don't understand people like that. I wonder whether they're real scientists. There's a curiosity of the human mind. That's why at university. Follow the questions. Right, okay, that's enough about that. Let's see. Is there something between God and energy? Well, I'm not sure what that would mean. But what I would say is this. The law of conservation of energy says that you cannot increase or decrease the available energy. It raises the question, of course, where the energy came from in the first place. You see, the very interesting thing behind this is, that the standard model of physics has forced people to believe that there was a beginning to space-time. And it used to be that most people reduced it to mass energy and left the question of where it comes from open. Now, they want to take an extra step and they want to say it comes from nothing. I give a lot of lectures on nothing these days. It's one of the most interesting topics that you could ever give a lecture on. Because it creates a vast difficulty. It was Leibniz, I think, that said, why is there something rather than nothing? Now, this is one of the biggest questions because it's very difficult to get something from nothing. As you will see, if you read the book, The Grand Design by Stephen Hawking, just listen to it if you like a bit more logic before we stop. Because there is a law of gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. What? Now, this is the key statement of his book. Let me repeat it. Because there is a law of gravity, because there is something, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. Flat contradiction, number one. It's worse still. The universe will create itself. Well, if I say to you, X creates Y, roughly speaking, that means if you've got X, you'll get Y, yes? If I say X creates X, what does that mean? Well, it means that nonsense remains nonsense even if scientists write it. It's absurd. It's even worse. Because there is a law of gravity, he doesn't say because gravity exists. And he's falling under the mistake that Wittgenstein points out. What would a law mean if there's no reality that it describes? And if you unpack that, you'll find that many leading thinkers are confused about law. They think it creates things. I once had a conversation with Peter Atkins, our professor of physical chemistry. I bet there are dozens of books in this university written by him. He's a brilliant textbook writer. So I said to him, Peter, what do you think created the universe? He said, mathematics. And I started to laugh. I was caught out, and I shouldn't have laughed, but I did laugh. And he said, why are you laughing? Well, I said, I'm a mathematician, Peter, and that's just about the foolish, stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life. And he said, why? Well, I said, let me keep it simple. 1 + 1 = 2. Did that ever put £2 in your pocket? Have you heard of the financial crisis? Yes? That was the result of people believing that mathematics could create money, wasn't it? We call it creative accounting. This idea that laws create is a huge confusion. Laws describe. Newton's laws of motion never moved a billiard ball in the history of the universe. People with cues do that. So we must realize that these laws are not causes. They don't cause anything to happen. They describe what happens, when it happens. The confusion is vast at this level, and we need to sort it out. And you see, Hawking hasn't answered his question at all. Now, the difficulty with nothing is that if you cannot get a universe easily from nothing, you redefine nothing. Yes, you do. Because nothing in Hawking's book becomes a quantum vacuum or something else. And it becomes physical. Listen to this. I wonder what you'd think of this if you found a high school student writing it. Because something is physical, nothing must be physical, especially if you define it as the absence of something. What? Because something is physical, nothing must be physical, especially if you define it as the absence of something. Do you know who wrote that? One of the world's most famous astrophysicists, Lawrence Krauss. It's utterly absurd. They cannot get a universe from nothing, so they try to make nothing physical. But then I was having an interesting debate at Harvard MIT Faculty Club with Alan Guth, who's the father of modern astrophysics, an utterly brilliant man. He invented the theory of inflation. And when we were standing together, we had a very friendly discussion. I said, Alan, I want to ask you a question. I said, out there, there's a great deal of talk about nothing. He said, I know there is. I said, now, when you talk about nothing, you do not mean, do you, the absence of anything as we use it in everyday language? He said, no, we don't. I said, thank you very much. They have not succeeded, even though there's book after book after book claiming to get a universe from nothing. And the absurdity to which they're reduced shows to me that the alternative is, of course, much more sensible. I do not believe the universe came from nothing. It came from nothing physical, but it came by the creation of God, who is not physical or material. God is spirit. So, we're nearly at the end. I promised to finish in a couple of minutes, so I'm going to do that. How did I leap from deism to theism? I didn't leap. What I did was presented arguments that I believe pointed to God. Now, the difference between deism and theism is, deism is the idea very popular in the 18th and 19th centuries of the idea that God started it off and let it run. A couple of times tonight, I said that God is the creator and the upholder of the universe. I'm a Christian, I'm not a deist. So I don't make a leap from deism to theism, except in the sense that if you look at the arguments, strictly speaking, that I've given you today, they get you as far as believing there is a God of some kind, perhaps a deistic God, perhaps a theistic God. There is an intelligence behind the universe. Now, I haven't argued any further than that, but if you want me to go further, of course I can go further. And it's the very question that was asked by you, actually, that relates to this. Do I believe that Jesus was not only the Son of Man, but the Son of God? Now, that's not exactly on the topic, you know, that we're discussing tonight, but it's relevant for this reason. Because I've said a couple of times that I was a Christian. So since you've asked me about that, even if it's not on the topic, I'm going to be very kind, and I'll answer you. The others can listen in if they like. But if you don't want to listen to this because you're only interested in the topic, then just shut your ears for 2 minutes. In the beginning was the Word, is what I've said tonight. That there's an intelligent God who creates a universe that operates according to linguistically described laws, and in it there are beings made in his image who are capable of producing text, and all life itself is based on text. That's step number one. It's only step number one. Because coming down to the more specific Christian claim, the central Christian claim is the Word became human and lived among us. That's a colossal claim. It's a big enough claim in the 21st century academy to say in the beginning was the Word, because many people don't believe there was a Word. It's a very much bigger claim to say that the Word became human. You ask, was Jesus just human or was he God? I believe with all my heart he was God, because I believe that's the way the evidence points. Now you say, come on. And when I see you say, come on, I think of a collection of 800 atomic physicists in a big institute in another country. And after my talk, a professor from Oxford came up to me and he said, well, now, Professor Lennox, that was a very nice talk. And I can say, yes, there is some evidence for a deistic God. But I think you're a Christian. He was very sharp, you see. I think you're a Christian. And he said, now you're obliged to believe, aren't you, that Jesus was both human and God. I said, that's right. Oh, he said, come on. come on, we're in the 21st century and you're a professor of mathematics. I said, now you've asked all the questions. We'll come to your question. Can I ask you simpler questions first? He said, sure. I said to him, tell me, what is consciousness? He said, I don't know. I said, okay, you don't know, right? Let's try a simpler thing. What is energy? Well, he said, we can measure it, we can use it. I said, what is it? Shorter, longer hesitation, I don't know. Oh, I said. Tell me, I said, do you believe in consciousness and energy? Yes, I do. And you don't know what they are. I said, should I write you off as a physicist and dismiss you? He said, please don't. I said, 5 minutes ago, you were going to write me off. Because I couldn't explain to you anything about how the deity of Jesus relates to his humanity. I said, of course I can't explain it to you. If we can't explain the simpler things like energy and light and gravity and consciousness, how do you think I can explain to you the consciousness of God? But I said, let me pursue this. Why do you believe in energy and consciousness, even though you don't exactly know what they are? I said, I think that you believe in those concepts because of their explanatory power. And I said, when I look at Jesus Christ and what he did in history, what he did for people, the track he's left in history from the first century to the 21st, when I see what he's done in my life, in the life of my wife and family, when I see what he's done in transforming the lives of others, I find that the explanation that says he was both God and human is the only one that makes sense. And that's why I believe it, in part. You see, your question is totally valid. Because what I'm claiming, of course, you'll have realized this, is this world is not the only world there is. There is super nature, and it breaks into nature in our rationality. Because in our rationality, God is giving us evidence of the origination of the universe. And that prepares our minds for the much bigger thing. Because you see, ladies and gentlemen, it's fascinating to believe that there is a God. And to have scientific reasons for doing so. It is an infinitely greater thing to get to know God. And I believe that's possible. The science is a pointer. It's not the whole story. But the whole story is a topic for another time. Thank you very much indeed.
Lecture is coming to close, and I just want to say that if you want to hear John Lennox yet again this week, it is possible. Visit johnlennox.cz, johnlennox.cz, and there will be an opportunity to hear him again on a similar topic. Also, as you come out of the lecture hall, you will be given an invitation to similar lectures given by different speakers next week. So it's a leaflet similar to this roll-up. And you'll also be able to see the lecture online at the university website, at the Faculty of Philosophy. And I would just once again really like to thank Professor John Lennox for making time, coming over to the Czech Republic, to Prague, and investing his time into this lecture. Thank you very much. Ti, kteří mají zařízení překladatelské, prosím, nezapomeňte ho odevzdat a přeji hezký večer.